Picking up on from last week, I wanted to get more into your book, Art Class and Cleavage. Came out, what, in 98? The second book on Zappa, actually. Yeah, it came out in 1998. It's a very good book, and it does spell out the background to what you do in negative dialectics. And you have here, commenting on a quote, I'll read the whole section. Reference, Ezra Pound on the task of literature. Quote, it has to do with the clarity and vigor of, quote, any and every thought and opinion. It has to do with maintaining the very cleanliness of the tools, the health of the very matter of thought itself. When the application of word to thing goes rotten, i.e. becomes slushy and inexact or excessive and bloated, the whole machinery of social and individual thought and order goes to pot. This is a lesson of history and a lesson not yet half learned. Are you giggling there?
Yeah, I'm laughing. Yeah. Well, simply because all the cultural stuff that we like to talk about, Bob, we talk about Finnegan's Wake and Captain Beefheart and Frank Zappa, are all about this slushing.
That's right. So, of course, that means Pound is wrong, and you nail him. That is actually something called Polite Essays, London, 1937. You say the idea of words as tools might seem to echo Blaschnikov's insistence on the externality of language, but it obviates the need to understand each utterance in its concrete social situation. And I'll just say that's exactly McLuhan's point. That's where McLuhan is not a Poundite. Then you say a tool is the private property of the craftsman. It is not the public. Dialogical pivot of Blaschnikov. Then you nail Pound. You say Pound's fascist poetics had a disastrous effect on the whole world, and that's why World War II started. Okay, so...
I don't think I quite said that. We'll have to pardon Bob Dobbs' slight exaggerations for radiophonic exhilaration here.
Yeah, the exhilaration of having an audience and being electrified. But you say Pound's fascist poetics had a disastrous effect on American poetry.
Well, that's definitely true.
All right. Now, what's interesting is let's see if we can match and get on the same page here. The point about each utterance in its concrete social situation is what I understand McLuhan means when he said the medium is the message. The ground for expression, the ground for communication is the technology, the environment, the older media. You must look at the concrete social situation, which Marshall would say that's it's a way of defining medium, a concrete social situation. So that's why I find it interesting that these Voloshinov's overlaps jive with what McLuhan's saying, and that's why we could converge here.
Definitely, but there's another thing that's hovering in my mind, trying to explain to a putative electronic audience who might download this as a podcast or stream this to their computer, thinking about what they're thinking, which is that when we say this about what a statement is, I'm thinking, and I think you're thinking, about our desire to investigate it, our desire to be creative, to be literate, to be productive, that we want to go and investigate specific things. And I often find people cannot understand what the hell I'm talking about because they don't see the reason to go into this, to dive in. Whereas I feel the need to explain things is very pressing. And this might come from both of us have trainings in the study of literature that we want to write, that we have this put in us.
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, no, that's what I'm.
Oh, okay.
I'm really enjoying thinking that McLuhan had enough dialectical understanding of real processes to understand that every abstraction actually is an ideal statement which is untrue, that he's a genuine materialist. Because a genuine materialist says the development of the universe is specific and concrete, that truth is concrete and material. It doesn't reside in the abstractions that we find, however useful they are. Whereas the Cartesians and the Platonists, they think that the real thing is the abstraction that you can make. So I find it fantastic for you to, from your McLuhanite perspective, to agree with what I would argue is the Marxist perspective, that reality is specific and unique and no butterfly lands on the leaf in exactly the same way. we need abstractions to talk about things. We need abstractions all the time, and we use them, but they aren't the truth. The truth is the actuality, the materiality. So we've formed a real unity on that. But I suppose I'm introducing a kind of, I've got a voice in my head which isn't too pleasant, and I sort of hope that you'll kill it rather than just going, say some more, but maybe this is what you, I need to explain this voice, which is that maybe this desire to investigate specific things is pushed into you by a certain level of education or a certain hope that you're going to enter this world of literate people who are productive. And does this ever haunt you? You know, when you're trying to speak for the electronic masses, that maybe you come from this literate, you know, layer of society that has kind of illusions about what life is. And sometimes I feel, well, those are all illusions, and actually living and breeding your kind is the real stuff. And I've sort of got my head involved with this kind of funny area.
That is the crux of the modern communicator, what you're talking about, because the very tools that make you articulate, which provides content for the talking head world we've been in for the last 50 years, are the very tools that kind of blind you to the medium you're on and other kind of effects. And I see that Joyce and McLuhan were trying to make the educated, literate person see the disservices of their expertise.
I like that a lot, what you're saying, because it's, this is like, I mean, there's a horrible phrase, cultural jamming, is it? But this idea of jamming the smooth flow in order to make you reflect on what's actually going on is, to me, explains a lot of the things which I really like, which some of my straighter friends go, how can you like that? That's noisy, or that's unpleasant. And I said, well, what's unpleasant is actually you realizing that this discussion that you think you're having via some medium like a newspaper or a television is no discussion at all, and it's making you wake up to the fact that it is newsprint or that you are watching a flat screen. The funny thing is, my word for that is materialism, or a kind of pathetic destruction of the idealist balloon, whereas your word for it is
medium, I guess. Medium.
Or will you come up with tactility?
No. Oh wait, tactility is the qualities of original of speech when people were, quote, primitive and before writing, and we retrieve the tactile qualities of speech with the electric environment, electric media.
Well, let's choose a specific example, because one of the hopes that I have in these discussions is that we can get in, because we share an aesthetic bent and therefore we know some of the same material pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, my example of this is a puffed...
Well, Ben, before you go, I want to say this, that what you've already said shows where we seem to be agreeing. Now we need to tease apart where we don't mean the same thing. And it began by you asking me to define tactility. So that's where we're sort of going. You know what I mean? The dialectical. We seem to converge, then we find out, no, that's not what I thought you meant.
Let's converge and then go out the other side and then form some kind of... That's the printing machine here. It's got a little plastic flap which I flicked, because in order to talk to you I have to kind of draw things in the air, even though that isn't going on the radio. And I was trying to form a figure of eight in the air with my fingers, and I flicked this bit of plastic that sticks out the printer, so it went click like that. But we converge and then diverge, and this could form a, you know, a figure of eight thing, which might be more interesting than just a dot and might be closer to actually how atoms and the universe are really constructed. But a puffed and flabulent Japanese I'm not even quoting it right, but that doesn't matter. A puffed and flabulent Japanese rubber goods mask. And I'm quoting from Bongo Fury. It's Captain Beefheart. It's... And I've got this, just an image in my head, which is hearing stuff like that, Beefheart in full flight of beatnik, incomprehensible, verbiastic relish of the words.
Tactile.
You can't understand it. You can't go and say, oh, I agree with this, I don't agree with that. It's a beautiful description of a sunset, actually. All these things you can't say. And in terms of pop radio, it's a jamming. It's like not pop radio. And I think that's what they meant. And that's my example of something that I adore, because it blocks the sense that all pop radio is about is beautiful people who express beautiful ideas, and we understand it straight away, and we're all in this lovely flow. And to put that in suddenly puts everything in question. And that's where I suppose I have a lot of sympathy with, and then people who I don't agree with, finally, but with this idea of being objectionable in the cultural field as being necessary. And I think if we both like Frank Zappa, being objectionable in the cultural field, being having no commercial potential and these sorts of things is something that we're fascinated by or agree with.
Yes, that is the, to me it seems to be Wyndham Lewis was one of the prototypes of what he called, or what McLuhan said he was doing. He provided an anti-environment to the environment. And the environment or the medium lulls people to sleep. They accept clichés yeah. and assumptions, and they don't know the danger of that and in perceptual health and social health. So that the artist is to do what my friend calls a pattern interrupt. And the orneriness of Wyndham Lewis was that. Joyce did a pattern interrupt for all his literate audience with Finnegan's Wake, and before that Ulysses, but especially Finnegan's Wake. And McLuhan carried on the tradition, and Zappa did. They are trying to wake people up, but they're not trying to bug you. They're not trying to be silly like Jerry Lewis or something. They're not trying to, say Wild Man Fisher. He's doing a pattern interrupt, and he doesn't even know it. He's just, quote, schizophrenic or whatever.
And in fact, the idea of pattern interrupt is like the absolute orthodox law within art schools. I mean, you get this situation where young people think that if they go and offend an audience, they've won, and that's the whole point. And therefore, they, will often play with all sorts of ideas they don't actually agree with, regressive, fascist, racist, sexist, nasty ideas, and they'll play with these ideas because it pattern interrupted. And I sort of scratched my head and said, no, that's not quite what's meant. You've sort of done it in this cheap way, that's sort of gone against your own little moralistic system, and you think you've broken out, but actually, you're not changing people's brains. You're merely making yourself famous by being obnoxious. And in music, I discovered there was a whole area of pianists who called themselves the most diabolical interruptive, and then I'm stupid for talking about this, and this is the problem of talking like this without all my footnotes and records, and I can't pull out the one I'm thinking about, but they were like the terrible ten of the piano in 1910. But they all played stuff which, when you listen to it, is kind of watered down Chopin, and they hammered and they used their elbows. But when you actually hear the music, it was nothing. And in fact, I think I had to leave music journalism because of the faux avant, the sudden universal acceptance that transgression is the thing. And suddenly finding, I'm not here, this isn't why I liked it. I actually liked it. I didn't like it because it was transgressive. I liked it, in the first place. As soon as I saw Feeling His Way, I actually liked it. I didn't think, oh, this is transgressing everything, therefore it must be good. But people are thinking like that, are kind of out of touch with their own responses.
Yeah, exactly. Now, McLuhan in 67 and even earlier started to say, we will start seeing all kinds of bizarre forms of expression. Now, he's saying that as a pattern interrupt. He wanted people to notice that you're going to get this art school cliché transgression.
You think so? You think so, Bob? Because you're putting a spin on the words. It's very interesting, this, because you are going to see a whole... say it again.
Many other sentences that he said, but that's why I know what he meant. But I'm just saying, it was a journalist that he said... We can expect to see many bizarre, distorted forms showing up. Now, he wasn't talking, judging that. He said, we're going to see eccentricity of individual communication in Western society because the satellite theater, the global theater, does make Westerners go this way. So the very countercultural, now art school aesthetic, was a pattern that he predicted, and he said, we need to wake these people up. So they're just going along with the mainstream effect. They're somnambulists, even though they replay the 19th century image of eccentric or anti-environmental or individuality. They don't know that the major media requires this, and therefore it'll all be commercialized. The whole complaint about, you know, this eccentricity becoming commercialized and commodity, he predicted. He said this is something we need to wake the young kids up to if they want to be really leading edge or really avant-garde. They're not going to be it in a traditional way.
Now we can be analytical and have a meta-discourse about the average art school tyro and what they believe. When we're cutting into that particular kind of vanity, that is the beginning of our revolution.
Yes, yeah. And so you know that Wyndham Lewis, the more you read, he began this. He said you have the slumming of the rich pretending they're artists.
He's talking is it bourgeois bohemians is his phrase, or have I got that from someone else?
I think so.
He's talking about the rich people who go to Paris and put on a beret and stand there with easels and garrets, like thinking that they're being impressionists, and they're doing it like 30 years too late. And they're
apes of God.
Yeah.
But let me just supplement that. It's important. He starts writing in 1919. He's talking about the fame of Picasso and those people. And he says, these artists are so behind the times, they still work in studios. He says the real artist should grab the lapel of the mayor of London and demand to be part of the architectural city and town planning. We need to make it environmental, not work in the studio. He was articulating a purposeful role for the artist that the dadaists were just sort of instinctively knew, well, this is regular artist crap. Well, what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. He actually had a program which he knew probably wouldn't be understood. So he was, as a subtext, was pattering, interrupting everybody, saying, look, you guys are not being what we as artists could do.
Now, I wish we had the technology now to Skype Esther Leslie, who's sleeping over there with little Mordecai, who's just had his first birthday. He was crying, so she's feeding him, and they generally fall asleep about this time. And I wish we had the technology to Skype her and get her in on the discussion, because I can see her being quite shocked at how Anglophone we're being, that we're talking about that our education as you know, we do like reading stuff in English. And we found this revolutionary stuff, the particularly the relationship between Wyndham Lewis and Joyce. And I so like meeting up with you, Bob, because so many people seem to be Joyceans, or they know about Lewis, but they don't see how productive their conflict is. But this Anglophone literature, from Esther's point of view, if we could access her asleep, if we had the technology to, you know, find that little socket in her brain and stick the wire in and, you know, get into her dreams and pop up as some entity within a dream and get her into the discussion, I'm sure this technology will arrive soon. Then she would say, Bob, your enthusiasm with Wyndham Lewis saying, what are artists doing? Come on, let's change the architecture, is just a tip of an iceberg of a whole modernism which swept Europe and particularly revolutionary Russia completely. You know, the complete argument of the artists during the Russian Revolution is we are shaping reality. We have the ability to shape reality now because our subjectivities are no longer constrained by the bourgeois system. Our subjectivities are alive and quivering and out in the open. We can go and shape the world. So what is this thing with paintings? And when Malevich actually makes a painting of a black square, what he's saying is that painting has just become that. It's just an object within, and we have to think about, well, do we want a black object like that in this environment? And he's beginning that turn towards reshaping reality, which is the whole revolutionary argument. So you might have found it in Lewis, and I think Lewis is quite a distorted echo of that very hopeful modernism, because of the whole backwardness of England culturally, and therefore we can find it in him, but I find it a weird and distorted trace of that argument. I wouldn't find it the font of it, that if you look at European modernism, and if you look at Bertolt Brecht, and you look at You look at Mayakovsky in Russia, or these names are not my fingertips, but if you look at, there's just huge amounts of thought about that going on in Europe, because it's revolutionary times, and in revolutionary times people throw off the role that they've been that's been put on them. Oh, you are someone who makes paintings. They're going to say, well, no, my painting is really important. And at certain times you're going to think that people, that you can ally with other people in creating something else, and that's the revolutionary moment. I mean, do you feel this about Lewis, or is Lewis for you still the absolute statement of that revolutionary turn?
No, I agree, and Lewis knew it. Lewis was the most avant-garde man in London, because he was in touch with the constructivists and everybody.
Well, absolutely. I mean, his whole movement is a response to Marinetti, isn't it? Marinetti comes to London and does some great...
No, that's before World War I. That's 1913, 1914. He then becomes a different person in 1918, 1919, after the war. He changes. He knows it's a different situation. And he, in The Art of Being Ruled, critiques the Russian constructivist thing, because he said they did not know the full extent of the revolutionary potential around us, and therefore they were going to get bogged down, which they did. He almost predicted that they would be stuck with the reactionary socialist realism that came in.
But well, I've got to reread that text, Bob. I've got to reread that text, because I never saw that in it. I never thought.
Oh, there's a whole. He reviews this enthusiastic woman who writes about the great revolution of the constructivists and all that's going on in the late teens and early 20s. I don't have the name right at the tip of my. But you'll read that chapter. It's beautiful critiques. But the second reason I bring up Lewis is that when I was in New York, I went to the Met a lot, because it was around my neighborhood. And I could
You're talking about
in.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Yeah. So
you call it the Met.
Nice, pretty art.
Bob, stop. We've got to communicate with some people here. You call it the Met. I think here, among people I know who've visited New York, we call it MoMA. Is that the same place?
No, that's the Museum of Modern Art.
Okay, sorry. You're talking about... Tell me a bit about New York museums. Which is which?
Okay, there's MoMA. MoMA's the Museum of Modern Art.
Okay.
Built in... started in the 20s with Rockefeller money.
Okay.
The older museum is the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Okay.
And that's the older building, started in the 19th century by the Carnegies and people like that. Maybe even some Rockefellers there. But... and then you have the Whitney...
Forget the Whitney. Tell me about the Met and tell me what's in it. Well, what would I see? Is it Rubens?
Everything.
Oh, is everything?
It's the big encyclopedia. Pacific art, caveman art, Chinese art. It's huge. You know, it has the whole... It's like Citizen Kane's warehouse. It's got every artifact ever.
Okay, so there's the history of art for you in person. Or in object, anyway.
So they have a wonderful modern bookstore with all the glossy Pomo books. And there's a book called Isms. And they run through all the art isms, a nice little one-page section. So it's a nice little compendium of art history for the last 1,000 years. And it has every obscure ism ever invented, but one is left out. One. Most important.
You don't tell me. Vorticism, really.
Vorticism is not in the book.
Mm.
That's a scandal. That's because the socially proper people who fund these museums and train these art school students, they all know Wendell Lewis was a fascist and had nothing to contribute, and we're certainly not going to acknowledge him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So that's very interesting, because followers of the writer Ian Sinclair in Britain have attempted to argue that what we've got with Prynne and with the people around him is neo-vorticism. That what we got with Ian Sinclair is a neo-vorticism, an attempt to make vorticism happen again, you know, and feeling exactly what you're talking about, that it's been written out of history. And there's a very interesting class component of this. I mean, I feel this a lot, because I take little Iris, 3.5, to a nursery 3 times a week in Bloomsbury, and Bloomsbury is famously...
I went there with you.
Well, Bloomsbury is the university area of London, and it's where Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf and Hogarth Press and T.S. Eliot, there's a plaque on a wall just by the Institute of Education bar where I take Iris to have a yogurt, and it's Thomas Stearns Eliot worked here between, you know, has the dates, which is interesting, you know, that such a great poet actually had to work in a publisher's most of his life. And
I was taken on a tour through that area by another poet and showed me all that stuff while I was at your place.
Right, yeah. Well, that's Bloomsbury. And Bloomsbury essentially wiped out vorticism. You see, why does vorticism not exist in the Met? And I think we have to blame Bloomsbury. And if you look at Bloomsbury, it's a bunch of quite... They are upper-class group. And they thought they could adopt little bits of nice modernism from Europe and kind of turn it into their thing. So, and then we get the sticky problem, what do you think of Virginia Woolf? And I have to say, after The Waves, I can't even read her. And after The Waves, her book, The Waves, when I read the earlier stuff, I get disenchanted with it, even though Mrs. Dalloway's Diary is quite a good schizophrenic explosion. And what do you think of that bunch of people? And when you pitch Lewis as an angry figure, for me, you have to pitch him against the Bloomsbury group and those people. That's really what he's against. That to understand his anger in other ways, you know, to think he's ranting against Lenin or ranting against socialism or he's ranting against George Bernard Shaw, I don't think it would quite catch him. I think his anger was that he was the best painter Britain's produced, and I think he was in his early phase, and nobody can see it because these cushy aristocratic people swanning around in Bloomsbury are like ruling the cultural thing, you know, and I think that's his anger. Or how do you, I mean, this is a very typically Brit, class-ridden, angry version of what you're talking about. But does that fit with what you've studied about Lewis?
Oh, yeah, I know all about that, and I don't want to emphasize that. I want to emphasize that nobody had a clue what Lewis was doing, because when McLuhan met Lewis in 1943, he had studied Lewis at Cambridge in 35-36, read all his books, was inspired by him, and then when his mother, who was a very eloquent theatrical person, did monologues, solo acts, was known as an elocutionist, she knew that Lewis was teaching in Windsor, just across from Detroit. So
Right, it's not just across from London. You're not talking about the Royal Borough here.
Windsor, right?
Hang on,
we've got to bring
Iris into this show, I'm afraid. Iris, come here. I'm talking to Bob Dobbs. Come here. Say hello to Bob. Bob knows you. Say hello to Bob.
Iris. I love your radio persona, Iris. Very clever, very astute. You're going to be big, Iris.
Look, Bob's been listening to your radio stuff, and he's there in Hawaii, and this screen has become like a window on another house. It's like there's a house in Maui, Hawaii, that's there and accessible, and something's just fallen away. I've never been impressed with technological communicative things, really. I don't like the telephone, because you're so just talking to one person. But this, I find completely extraordinary. I find Skype extraordinary. Excuse me, listeners, we've got to talk about Skype a bit because this is what's enabling us to talk. And my daughter, Iris, who's 3.5, has just woken up and needs comforting. And I brought her and I'm trying to include her in this discussion. Do you understand
that? Yes, if we could click on the visuals and she could see me and see the home.
I have to go find the camcorder.
Yeah,
do you want to see
that.
Bob?
So can I carry on, or do we have to keep...
Do you find it funny that you can't see him? I mean, would you like to see him, or can you just listen? We'll just listen. Yeah. Okay.
She's going to be very beautiful.
Iris is... she's got Toku, her comfort blanket, and she's quite tired, so maybe she'd just like to hear us going on talking about vorticism for a while. We're talking about Bloomsbury, where I take you to the nursery, and we're talking about what it means and... Yeah, was that okay?
The battles the adults conducted around the nursery.
That's right.
What I was saying is that when McLuhan was told by his mother that Lewis, and McLuhan was down in St. Louis, interesting, and he married a woman named Corinne Lewis. See, Corinne Lewis, he was already married to, he's in St. Louis, and his mother says Wyndham Lewis is lecturing up in the Detroit-Windsor area. He booted up there with his friend, Felix, and they met. And so then they, McLuhan immediately invited him to St. Louis to get painting commissions, because Lewis had no money. He was starving. And this is after the hotel was burnt down.
So you know, McLuhan found him work. Now, I read a really boring biography of Wyndham Lewis written by one of those people who gets all the letters. And when you read all the letters from an artist painter like Wyndham Lewis, all the letters are saying is, you haven't paid me for my portrait. Will you please pay me? So it was really painful reading. But this guy, if he'd had any sense, would have sort of underlined a bit about Marshall McLuhan meeting Lewis. I mean, that's really interesting, but I don't remember it from this biography I'm slagging off, whose name I can't remember. The book is actually just behind me, and I'd go and get it out, but I've got Iris on my knee, so I don't think I'm going to carry her over there and do that.
Are you talking about the 1980 book, The Enemy, authored by Jeremy somebody or Jeffrey somebody?
Yeah, it sounds like a Jeffrey.
Yeah, that is, there is a whole section on McLuhan.
I didn't notice it. You see, Bob, I didn't notice it because you've alerted me to McLuhan now, and probably I'd just have, you know, you don't notice things until, you know, somebody has pointed them out to you.
Yeah, you were allergic to the concept of McLuhan and your image of it. So you would just say, oh, that's irrelevant to notice McLuhan. You know, he's not relevant. But there's it's very interesting. It's very perceptive what McLuhan says about Lewis. And we have a letter. I don't know if it's quoted in the book. We have McLuhan just describing exactly the problem of being a supporter of Lewis and how Lewis was a paranoid and would undercut you, even though you supported him. And he totally clinically, now he's only 35 or something at that point. And he's talking to about a person who's 20 years older than him. But McLuhan, as a young man, understands how great Lewis is, but also why he becomes paranoid and how he's a basket case to deal with personally. But here's the amazing thing is that...
I'm laughing because you're talking about Wyndham Lewis being a cantankerous old git. And in my life, I've always really liked cantankerous old gits, you know, when I was younger. And the weird and nice thing is now I'm turning into one, and that's just fine. You know?
That's all right.
But you're not a cantankerous old git, are you? You're a sunny kind of I'm going swimming on the beach kind of person.
I'm a sunny Jim. I'm Jimmy Joyce, and you're Wyndham Lewis.
Oh,
this
right.
is the dialectic
okay.
here.
Except and, I love Joyce over Lewis, actually. But then that's the twist, isn't it?
What did you say? What's over Lewis?
But I love Joyce over Lewis. But this is the twist that's required, isn't it? It's the figure of eight that makes me go like that when I'm doing it with my hands, you know?
Yep, exactly. I'm Lewis celebrating Joyce, and you're Joyce celebrating Lewis, yet we're each other.
No, it's the other way around. It's the other way around. But this is Shem and Sean in Finnegan's Wake, crossing sides. Do you know the Clive Hart analysis of Finnegan's Wake? Clive Hart's structure of Finnegan's Wake, which he's since then given up. I spoke to Clive Hart at some Finnegan's Wake seminar, and I love his book, and I talked about it, and he said, I don't believe it anymore. I think it's all random buzz. I don't understand Finnegan's Wake, and he kind of given up. But in structure, I can't remember the name.
Let me tell you.
Let me finish on this book. About the figure of eight, because he says that the twins, the opposite principles in Finnegan's Wake, Shem, who represents the artistic bohemian side, and Sean, who represents the more business button down side, change places through the book. And in the middle of the book, they are commenting on the text, and you get the sort of playful comments on one side and the scientific ones on the other. And then they go through this weird figure, which is strangely like a mathematical diagram, but could also be the mother's vagina. They change places. And he argues that the whole structure of Finnegan's Wake is a figure of eight on its side. And I just had to share that with you, Bob. That's the kind of awful verbiage used in encounter groups. But I want to tell you that, Bob, because I'm thinking about figure of eight. But you're a bit annoyed because you've got something on the tip of your tongue that I'm stopping you saying.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I retain it. I'm happy when I retain what I wanted to say 5 minutes ago. The figure on the eight, this book is very important. Structure of Motif in Finnegan's Wake. Isn't that the full title?
That's the full title. Your background in the Secret Service really is useful occasionally.
Yes. So that book is very important. I did not remember that...
Did you hear Bob clapping just then? You clapped. You're using your hands too. Yeah.
I'm excited. I'm a little kid excited. I did not remember that the figure eight on its side is a key symbol for Finney's weight, because that's the symbol for me on my tiny note chart, is the figure eight on its side. So that's great. Now, the other point is, the book came out in 1962, and it's that book that McLuhan cited and his son cited when he did the PhD on the 10 Thunders of Finney's Wake. That's Eric's son. They cite that because Clive Hart comes up to the point and he says TV is very important in Finnegan's Wake. Yeah. And he kind of states it. He's the first Joyce critic to do that. Remember, McLuhan already knew that, but he needs an academic source to qualify what he's going to say, and Clive Hart provided it. So the book is very important for McLuhan. And it's very interesting to find out that Hart collapsed because he could not go, he did not go through perceptual velocity enough revolution to get to the point McLuhan got with the insight of the role of TV in Finnegan's Wake. And it's a very important book.
So maybe that's why Clive Hart decided that there was no pattern, that it became like a, you know, pre-digital TV tuned into the cosmos with all these balls bouncing around, and he couldn't see that maybe that was the point.
That's right. He did not see the technical cause, the technical ground that the TV environment and the digital world has brought in. All information is erased now. It's a post-information, over-edited, leading to nowhere, null and void situation. And Joyce predicts that.
Mm.
That's one of the messages of the book. The very format.
Would you like to go to bed? No, you like. I'm sorry. I've still got Iris on my knee. This is a slightly weird way to pursue the hour, but Iris is on my knee, and I'm asking if she'd like to go to bed, so I was thinking you could cover us by just telling people listening a little bit about myself and Iris, but she's just said that she likes listening to you, Bob, so we better carry on.
Well, that's not unusual. So the very point, I cite in the part where I cheat, where I talk to Joyce through a medium, and Joyce told me years ago that he made sure that you could not find a anchoring concept, an anchoring statement or image for Finney's Wake. He wanted it to always be quicksand and swallow everything and nothing. There's no content at the bottom, no structure. But he did that intentionally to show that this is what the electric effect was going to do to reality.
Well, but then you've put all this free-floating sand of Joyce into a very firm box, which is McLuhan's particular technological determinist series of determined periods in human history, and now we're in the electronic, it's different from the printing press. And you've taken this shifting sand and stuck it in a box.
Yes, and
You do this, yes, and, you know. You always do that when I've actually shown you that you don't agree with yourself.
I don't agree with myself. I'm always swarming over, like a cubist painting, I'm swarming over the operation.
Oh, it's terrible. This sounds like one of those, what's that great film with that robot, the computer that produces this prosthesis, which is a folding octagonal kind of box that climbs out? You're frightening me now. I think, Bob, you're going to climb out like some horrible octagonal spider out of the screen.
No,
get us.
Yeah,
you think it'll get us, Iris? No? Iris is shaking her head. She doesn't think it'll get us.
It's called Videodrome. Videodrome.
Yeah. Is it?
Videodrome.
I can't remember the name. But
are you saying something?
Yeah, well, Videodrome makes me think of Rollerball, but, you know, and it, it actually copulates with the woman. It makes a child. And then, is that Videodrome?
Just a minute, Ben. I'm getting a slight echo. So what would cause that?
Well, you've been breaking up a little, you know, throughout. It got better and now it's got a bit worse.
Okay, let's just relax here. Let me just say a few things to get this out. Videodrome is a movie about McLuhan, by the Canadian Toronto filmmaker David Cronenberg. You probably don't remember. It's all about a McLuhan-based figure. So this is important to bring in Videodrome. It's a Canadian, you know, avant-garde filmmaker trying to wrestle with the meaning of McLuhan, which comes to what is James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake. Now, McLuhan said you can enjoy as a book Finnegan's Wake on the level you do, Ben, and slip and slushy and enjoy the words and the tactility of a print version of tactility. But McLuhan then had the perspective of later in the century to look back at the vortices, Lewis, Pound, Joyce, and Eliot, and Yeats, and see what they were pointing to unconsciously, which is the revolution in language that Voloshinov brought in, but McLuhan applied it to the newer languages. Okay? So that is a new form of knowledge, what McLuhan would say, a science. So we can slip into McLuhanism, but we're not mistaking the facts of Joyce as he understood Finney's Wake. Now, I think I told you last week I have a new medium, and I spoke to Joyce for 2.5 hours on March 22nd, and he explained how we talked about McLuhan and all. He says, yes, McLuhan is right, but I did not mean that when I did the Wake. He says, I had no idea what I was doing. I went to mediums all the time to figure out where the hell was I. It was an agonizing process. And he did not mean what McLuhan makes of the Wake.
Well, but Bob, you're
why McLuhan got that point. Well, and Bob, you're, thinks it's very important.
Bob, your outrageous assertions that you are interviewing people after the grave, which will make a lot of the people I'd like to talk to turn off their radios, has an element of interest in it for me, which is why I don't, you know, just stop talking
radio.
To you. This is not the radio I turn off, it's this Skype that makes the radio program.
Right.
Is because I do know that people said that James Joyce became quite superstitious towards the end of his life, was writing Finnegan's Wake. And I've been wrestling with this and thinking about this, and I think that the superstition that people perceive in those, and we might call them artists, but I think all sorts of people who aren't acknowledged as artists do this, who reflect upon themselves as mediated, as recorded in various, what Courtney Pimer called a hard object, such as a photograph negative or a piece of tape or... You see, I don't think it matters whether it's digital or not. I mean, it's just recorded, themselves recorded. That people who reflect upon that, who collect it and look back on it, do experience strange things about themselves and what is themselves and what's another person and what's shared and what a random thing can contribute. And this working through of how we're reflected into the bits that will be remembered after our death or looked at after our death and maybe not properly understood. This kind of consideration does produce an openness to the techniques which are used by people who will tell you your fortune and affair. And this is the way I'm thinking about this, why Joyce got superstitious towards the end of his life. And I put that in just as, you know, my plodding, you know, I feel like sometimes I'm a Watson to your Sherlock Holmes. I'm the plodding materialist explainer who comes after all these brilliant ideas and trying to say, well, yeah, but does it go here and does it go there? And you come along with this, you know, but it's a good relationship. And, you know, I support Watsons everywhere because that's my name. But that's how I interpret or will explain what you're saying. And just apologize, I suppose, to the people. I don't apologize really, because I mean, you know, everybody should take it on board, but your ability to talk to people after they're dead, I don't want to put them off too much, and I want to explain, you know, why I'm still talking to you, even though I find it pretty irritating.
Yes, I apologize for bringing it up, but let's go. I just want to say that it's so right about he appeared superstitious. The agony he went through in making the Wake. He really wanted to get it right, and he had nothing to compare it to, and he was really worried about it. And I told you last week that his wife loved the fact that he was going to mediums because it meant he wasn't going to prostitutes.
Well, it's a different kind of thing, but yeah.
Yeah. It's a great anecdote, even though it might be totally made up by the medium that I heard this through.
Anyways,
I want to go back to the Lewis. I was saying that McLuhan recognizing privately the problem of Lewis in his interpersonal relationship, still in the late 40s, is writing to Hugh Kenner and saying, I know it's a risk, but I know that Lewis is very important and I must begin to use Lewis material. And so even though he had a personal problem with Lewis, he recognized the knowledge level. At least McLuhan saw what he could exploit.
But Bob, you don't need personal interviews with James Joyce after his death to establish this. I mean, it's absolutely clear to me that there's a deep relationship between Joyce and Lewis. I mean, if you look at...
No, I'm not talking... Look, I'm talking about McLuhan.
Sorry, I just missed the name there, and then you go on, and then, you know... But, I mean, if you're confusing me, how much are you confusing anyone who listens into this? Can we have some clarity here? Who are we talking about and why?
Marsh McLuhan, I was quoting the letter that is used by Jeffrey, whatever his name is, for the book The Enemy, the biography that you find wimpy about Lewis.
Yeah. I don't find it wimpy. I find it dry and factual and boring.
Okay, factual. But there is a better letter that I have personally where McLuhan goes into explaining to another Canadian poet the problem personally with Wyndham Lewis. But McLuhan in the late 40s writes letters to Hugh Kenner saying, even though it's a risk to start talking about Lewis, I'm going to wake up Lewis and develop what I think Lewis has majorly discovered. And so he moved forward using Lewis or exploiting Lewis for a technical knowledge level, not worried about what a creep he was or what a problem he was personally. Anyways, the reason I find Lewis important is that aside from him as a great aesthete and a great artist and writer, is that he was the first to look at media environments and to question the Marxists and everybody else, the right wingers, with this new way of the extensions of language that were changing the 20th century. And McLuhan saw that Lewis saw that and developed it.
Okay, Bob, that's fantastic. But now I have a task for you that might surprise you. I've got to put Iris into bed now. And I want you to explain, after that very articulate explanation of the importance of Wyndham Lewis as something beyond left and right that needs to be considered, to explain why you're talking to me. To explain to the listeners a bit about me while I put Iris to bed, and then when you're through with that 2-3 minutes, I'll be back.
Okay, here we go. I'm stressing the importance of McLuhan for Marxists, that McLuhan acknowledges the discoveries that Marx made, very important discoveries, and the political implications of it. But when Ben discovers, along with a few others, the Russian linguist Voloshinov, I find that the quotes from Voloshinov helps me show that McLuhan is aware of what Voloshinov, building on his Marxism, discovered. And then I say, okay, now, as Ben is beginning to realize, that there's a point where McLuhan, this Roman Catholic jerk from the socialist and workers' point of view, or in tradition, and it's the reason why Ben blocked on McLuhan, here's this Roman Catholic guy, showing the Marxists how they can make a better revolution if they understand the seduction and tricks and games that media environments create. And what I find interesting is that Voloshinov and these people, and Baudrillard, or whoever was in between them, Frederick Jameson, these people get into the McLuhan zone, and they start to appreciate the media dynamics, and they don't really know enough about McLuhan to see how McLuhan has wrestled with the same issues and has come up with interesting breakthroughs. And then we come back to Wyndham Lewis, who McLuhan says he got it all from. And so then when you relate this to the art world, to the Bloomsbury group, Marsh McLuhan wrote an essay in the mid-40s on The New Yorker. And he pointed out how The New Yorker and the writers for The New Yorker were an extension of Bloomsbury. And you can see that McLuhan, a year after meeting Lewis in 43, 44, has absorbed Lewis's oeuvre, you know, with greater expertise than he had when he read it in Cambridge in the middle 30s. And he immediately applies and carries on the weaponry of Lewis, the ammunition, to nail the Bloomsbury afterimage in New Yorker magazine. And he then builds on that. And McLuhan becomes a great perceiver of problems that Gorbachev and Stalin had to deal with, and Brezhnev and everybody else, and Castro. So I think since McLuhan points out that the art schools that we start off complaining about are such dupes of the Bloomsbury effect, that McLuhan critiques and pattern interrupts what the kids learn in art school, and he got it from Lewis. So that Lewis and his trying to correct the art movements, not because of he didn't understand them, but because he was in the constructivist mode and understood how we could create social revolutions, understanding the new dynamics with artistic sensibilities, that it wasn't limited to the art world. And McLuhan has always made fun of the art world in the Lewis spirit.
And that's brilliant, and I like that. Sorry, I'm back.
All right.
Yeah.
Did you hear a bit of what I said?
I was checking it, you know, in between the fridge and getting a glass of milk and settling Iris down. I was hearing the gist, I think.
Yes, and so, Lewis, how did he say it? He, in 1929, he had a great way of saying it. I am part fascist, part communist.
I never liked all that particularly. That wasn't the bit I liked of what you were saying. The bit I really liked is it's the attack on the art scene from the aesthetic point of view. That's what I like, because you can attack art from all sorts of perspectives. You know, it should be more moral, it should be more political, it should be more humanist, it shouldn't do what it does, all those disapprovals. But to actually attack it from the other side, to say, you see, and that's why I like what you say, Bob, because of your absolute enthusiasm for music and for Frank Zappa, which we haven't mentioned much in this program. We got so into Lewis. And it's the criticism of how art is set up at the moment and what the art scene is, and saying that isn't art, they're wrong. And it's that gap, you know, that opens up. And yes, I mean, you know, Lewis as an artist couldn't find any political system, and so he made these statements that he doesn't take a stand. And the problem is, you quote them, and it could be quoted by any sort of person who thinks they're above what humanity is all striving for, you know.
I
find it kind of cheap.
Let me interject. That's where McLuhan is not a Lewisite. He recognized that the Lewis sensibility, like David Bowie and a few other people, they loved Lewis as a cyberpunk, and they liked his very thing that is taught in art school. That's what they project on Lewis. The secret part of Lewis, you wouldn't know unless you read McLuhan. And McLuhan was not, he knew that Lewis fans would end up being these art school jerks, okay, just being enemies for social cachet and for chicness. McLuhan went past that. That's why he's not a Joycean, not a Lewis, not a vorticist, but he builds on their stuff and then brings in science and Harold Innes and Marx and all these things, and makes a great quote synthesis, unquote, and a practical guide. So yes, he begins with the aesthetic, but he moves into the points that the major media environments are the art forms, what I call the Android meme, not anybody who's a content for it. Anybody who gets their 15 seconds attention. And yet you can see that is the whole population has become what I call manipians. So therefore it's not an anti-environment to be today.
The whole population has become manipians. You're saying the whole population has become anti-art and don't like being figureheads, that they all want to be active and actually use this stuff instead of looking at some so-called, I mean, you know, the absurdity. I always think of early Italian film, where they got film, this amazing medium, and they're all looking at these strongmen, these sort of ridiculous kitsch strongmen on flickering film, and that's the great thing. And it's like, but you got film that can film things, and you should have a camera, and we should make films, and our village could make a film. But no, we're all getting this new film in with some stupid strongman going, being muscly and prancing in front of us.
That's exactly McLuhan's point. Always the cultural hypnosis, the rearview mirror, becomes the content of art. And all through The Art of Being Ruled, Lewis is making fun of all the top artists of the 20s who are just replaying the 1890s. And so he's pointing out, and the actual point that the content of any new art form is always the previous art form, which was invisible in its day, and people had previous content to that. They're walking through the art worlds and movements backwards in looking at the rearview mirror is the very syndrome that McLuhan got from Lewis and developed it. And you can see it in Joyce. Past times are past times. Okay?
Yeah.
It's right there. There's so much Lewis knowledge in Finnegan's Wake. When you have mastered Lewis knowledge, and The Art of Being Ruled is a book that everybody should read, McLuhan considered as important as Machiavelli's The Prince as a guide to the 20th century. But of course, that was in the 50s. McLuhan then felt he went beyond all that because he had the advantage of the accelerated cultural revolution that happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So he was able to really build on and go beyond what Lewis even thought of, you know? So,
Bob, I've got to say a but. We're exceeding our time here for our constrictions. So next week, we're going to get back on this, and I'm going to return to you, because you've had a lot of this program. What I think about Wyndham Lewis is that, will that be all right, Bob?
Fantastic. We were getting to where we can begin.
Good.
To find our differences, but still try to have a revolution.
Cheers. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.